Drinking was the best way I knew, the fastest and the simplest, to let my feelings out and to connect, just sit there and connect with another human being. The comfort was enormous. I was an easier, stronger version of myself, as though I'd been coated from the inside out with a warm, liquid armor. It's true, it's a statement of fact, that alcohol was key to that feeling. I'd learned that years earlier, watching my father mix his secret potion in martini pitchers. And in places like the Ritz, I learned to tap into the same mystery myself, pouring myself over bars, pouring my emotions over people, pouring out all the stuff I kept bottled up. The amazing thing was you could open a bottle and build yourself a liquid bridge. That may be one of liquor's most profound and universal appeals to the alcoholic, the way it generates a sense of connection to others, the way it numbs social anxiety and dilutes feelings of isolation, gives you a sense of access to the world. You're trapped in your own skin and thoughts. You drink. You are released just like that. One drink and the bridge, so elusive in the cold, nerve-jangled sensitivity of sobriety, appears, waiting only to be crossed. In many ways, alcoholism has the feel of a psychological safety net, something a drinker constructs over a period of many years by making connections between feelings, like an emotional game of connect the dots. Take a difficult, sober feeling, shyness, fear, and connect it to its easier, drunken counterpart, disinhibition, courage. The net gets woven beneath you, a tight set of strings that promises to cushion you when you fall against a hard emotion. That's exactly what happened when I drank with Sam. Dot A, tension. Dot B, relief. In my head, out of my head. Disconnected, connected. There were so many transformations like that. Self-consciousness to less self-consciousness, inhibition to ease. I was painfully shy as a kid, shyer than my twin sister. And I hid behind her for many years, allowing her to speak for both of us, when visitors bent over us in crude questions. How old are you girls? What grade are you in? When I couldn't hide behind her any longer, when we began the process of separation that twins inevitably undergo, I turned to drink. When the feeling of shyness washed away my voice, there it was, the liquid solution, and there I was beside it, ready to reach for another one. Connect the dots, shy to less shy. Growing up, I had an unsafe feeling. My parents weren't cuddly types, so I didn't have access to comforting nooks like laps when we visited places where I felt scared. I remember being with my mother's family one Sunday and sitting at the table after dinner with the grown-ups. I was six or so, sitting silently as the adults talked, eating an Eskimo pie. At one point, my Uncle Joel caught my eye and said, "What are you doing over there?" Everybody looked at me, and I felt like I'd been caught doing something wrong, and I blushed. There was a great silence. Joel finally said, "I guess she's looking for the Eskimo who made that pie." And I felt so exposed I wanted to jump in my mother's lap and hide my head, but I couldn't. That unsafe feeling would stick with me for years, settling deep in my bones, but alcohol drove it out, replaced it with a feeling of courage. Drinking wine at age 19, 20, 21... I could sit at Sunday dinner with my family and simply not care about who was watching me across the table, not feel so tiny and vulnerable. Drinking wine, I could be the person I thought I was supposed to be, a more grown-up person who could appreciate the nuances of a fine Merlot and comment on how beautifully it went with the roast. I could fit in, and that gave me a feeling of tremendous relief. Fear plus drink equals bravery. There you go. Drinking always worked that way, at least it did until the end. There was a logic to it, an easy liquid logic that resolved some deep puzzle of need and wanting. Tennessee Williams describes this feeling in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, when Big Daddy asks Brick why he drinks. His answer, "I do it for the click." Click, it's right, it's me. To a drinker, the sensation is real and pure and akin to something spiritual. You seek, in the bottle you find. In the most general sense, drinking gave me a way to address whatever lingering confusion I had about the person I'd been brought up to be. Again, simple math. I grew up in a confusing home, and the drink made the confusion go away. It provided the easiest way out, an escape from my internal life. The first time I told my friend Elaine that my father was an analyst, she burst out laughing. We were at a bar with another friend, James, and we were all a little drunk, and they both just shrieked with laughter. Oh, my God, James said. Did he analyze you?
Oh, sort of, I said.
James kind of squealed with glee, which pleased me. I was shy, and James and Elaine both seemed much more worldly and sophisticated than me, and I liked being able to make them laugh. So I told them stories. I told them about a time when I was 12 and became morbidly depressed because our au pair had left and moved back to Denmark. I moped around the house for days and cried at night in my room, and my parents finally sent me to a shrink. James and Elaine howled at this. Oh, my God, Elaine said. Depressed over the au pair? How Cambridge can you get? I rolled my eyes and said, incredible, huh? I laughed with them. Ha ha. Let's have another drink. In fact, that was a rather sad story, a painful reminder of the way I'd been taught to deal with feelings like sadness. Externalize them, take them to a psychiatrist. But sitting there drunk, I felt none of that. Instead, I had a sense of something that felt new and exciting, something like rebellion, as though the door to a new version of me, a non-intellectual, non-analytical version, was opening before me. I liked being able to laugh with James and Elaine, to sit on bar stools and let my emotions spill out, the sense of disinhibited high amusement. And I liked the way drink helped turn me into someone more hardened and rebellious and cynical than the person I was raised to be, someone who could scoff and tell stories and make other people laugh. It was something I've been looking for all my life. Of course, the problem with self-transformation is that after a while you don't know which version of yourself to believe in, which one is true. I was the hardened, cynical version of me when I was with James and Elaine, and I was the connected, intimate version of me when I was with Sam, and I was the genteel, sophisticated version of me when I was with my relatives. And honestly, after a while, I didn't know which was which, where one began or ended, whether the versions existed authentically within me, or whether they needed outside people and circumstances to kick them into gear. For years, my therapist said to me, sit with the feelings. What happens when you just sit still by yourself? What happens when you just sit with the feelings? I suppose he was trying to get at those very questions. What kind of person was I, really? What was I afraid of, angry about? Who was I when I didn't have other people to cue into? I couldn't answer, of course, because I couldn't do it. I couldn't sit still for 10 minutes without a drink, without the anesthesia. I really couldn't. One of the first things you hear in AA, one of the first things that makes core gut-level sense, is that in some deep and important personal respects, you stop growing when you start drinking. The drink stunts you, prevents you from walking through the kinds of fearful life experiences that bring you from point A to point B on the maturity scale. When you drink in order to transform yourself, when you drink and become someone you're not, when you do this over and over and over, your relationship to the world becomes muddied and unclear. You lose your bearings. The ground underneath you begins to feel shaky. After a while, you don't even know the most basic things about yourself, what you're afraid of, what feels good and bad, what you need in order to feel comforted and calm, because you've never given yourself a chance, a clear, sober chance, to find out. Alcohol offers protection from all that, protection from the pain of self-discovery, a wonderful cocooning protection that's enormously insidious because it's utterly false, but it feels so real and necessary. And then, tragically, the protection stops working. The mathematics of transformation change. This is inevitable. You drink long and hard enough and your life gets messy. Your relationships become strained, your work suffers. You run into financial trouble or legal trouble or trouble with the police. Rack up enough pain and the old math, discomfort plus drink equals no discomfort, ceases to suffice. Feeling comfortable isn't good enough anymore. You're after something deeper than a respite from shyness or a break from private fears and anger. So after a while, you alter the equation, make it stronger and more complete. Pain plus drink equals self-obliteration. One morning, you wake up and open your eyes. Your head feels like it weighs way too much, so much it hurts to move. A sharp pain, a steady ache. You feel mildly nauseated, and you can't tell if you need to eat or if eating would make you sick. Inside, everything feels jittery and loose, like a car with bad wiring. Next to you in the bed is a man. Perhaps you know him, perhaps you don't. You experience a moment of disoriented panic. What happened? Exactly what happened?
and you take a quick inventory. Are you naked? Clothed? Is there any evidence of birth control? An empty condom wrapper? Your diaphragm case lying on the floor? You close your eyes. You want to pretend to be sleeping in case he stirs. Mostly, though, you want to collect your thoughts, try to patch the evening back together. Bits and pieces come back to you. You remember the early part of the evening clearly, the first few drinks, the way you started to loosen up. Then things start to get a little blurred. You remember laughing with this man. You were making jokes or laughing at his jokes. You felt giddy and light, and you had a sense of freedom. There are more drinks. Things get blurrier. At some point, there was touch. He put his hand on your arm, or you put your hand on his arm. You looked at each other, smiling, and you felt attractive, and that feeling gave you a sense of power and possibility. Your head pounds. You lie still in bed. The clear memories stop there, and all you have are snippets. You were telling him things, things that felt important, deep things. What were they? Something about your mother. Some elaborate theory about human nature you had one day on the bus. Some story, some detail. You strain to remember, and lying there in bed, this makes you cringe, this wondering what you said, how intimate it might have been. Other snippets. You remember leaning against him, or walking down the street with your arm around him, trying semi-consciously not to stumble on the sidewalk. You have a dim sense that the powerful feeling merged with a needy feeling, a wish for reciprocation. Does he find you attractive? How attractive? Are you attractive? The sex, if you remember it, was disconnected and surreal. You remember sliding into sexuality in an almost instinctive way, mimicking what seemed like the appropriate behaviors, kissing him, holding on to him, throwing your head back in pleasure even though you didn't really feel pleasure, even though you didn't really feel much at all. And then your mind goes blank. You don't remember the rest. You just have questions and they gnaw at you. Was he as drunk as you were? Did he notice how drunk you were? How much will he remember? Were you a lunatic? Are you a lunatic? You lie there with your eyes closed. All you want to do is get out. Just get out and go home and take a shower and get all of this out of your mind. Shove it straight back into history. No is a complicated word when you're drunk. This isn't just because drinking impairs your judgment in specific situations like parties or dates, which it certainly may. It's because drinking interferes with the larger, murkier business of identity, of forming a sense of the self as strong and capable and aware. This is a difficult task for all human beings, but it's particularly difficult for women, and it's close to impossible for women who drink. My friend Meg used to go out to bars and get drunk and go home with men. The sex was anonymous. She usually didn't remember their names in the morning. And the consummation of the act was in many ways beside the point. There was something deep and compulsive about the behavior, some part of her that felt driven. When she describes this, Meg talks about a component of anger and rebellion. She was in her late 20s and early 30s at the time, and she spent the better part of her young adult life responding to her fears about intimacy and sex by shutting men out, steering clear of relationships. There was something about drinking, something about getting drunk and sleeping with men she didn't know, that gave free rein to a host of buried feelings, to an undercurrent of neediness and longing she'd kept compressed in the darkest corner of her soul for years. And in some ways, this worked. Drunken, anonymous sex gave Meg the illusion of intimacy with none of the attendant risks, none of the aching vulnerability of sober sex. If you both long for intimacy and fear it, if you feel unworthy of it and ill-equipped to receive it and ashamed of yourself for wanting it, alcohol becomes a most useful tool, a way of literally drowning the conflict. It's a way of giving license to the part of you that wants to say yes. Yes to life, and yes to deep connection, and yes to touch and comfort and love. The sad thing is, whatever sense of affirmation you get from the anonymous drunken sex is usually metabolized away with the booze in your system. Meg would wake up in the morning and feel like an idiot. She'd feel shame and regret and confusion. Oh, shit. Head pounds, handshake, mind races. Oh, shit, what have I done? She'd wish she'd said no. Boundaries get so fucked up when you drink, so blurred. My sophomore year of college, some friends took over a lounge in one of the dorms on campus and threw me a birthday party, kegs of beer and bottles of vodka and trash cans full of ice everywhere. I wore a little black dress, one in a series of little black dresses I'd get plastered in over the years, and I got drunk and danced, something I never did sober. I danced with a guy named Bruce, who had dark curly hair and blue eyes and seemed sweet in a shy way. I remember getting drunk. I remember how the drink mixed with the rhythm of the music and gave me a sense of connection to my own body, gave it permission to move. And as the music shifted from fast to slow, I found myself leaning against Bruce, my face against his neck, his arms around my waist and back. There was a sense of surrender, a melting into the shape of his body, and a sense of myself as pretty and giddy and free. Flash forward an hour or two later. No memory of what happened, none at all. Somehow we ended up in bed in his dorm room, his roommate in the next bed. I had only the most dazed sense of this, a narrow twin bed, a fuzzy drifting in and out of consciousness, the briefest shock of recognition when it hit me that a penis, this man's penis, was pressing into me. After that, I guess I passed out. In the morning, I gathered up my clothes while Bruce was still asleep, put my black dress back on, and wobbled up the street toward my own dorm. It was 7 o'clock on a Sunday. The campus was deserted. I had a feeling of shame. Yes, no, maybe. Yes on one level, no on another, yes and no on yet another. Truman Capote once wrote that he saw in Elizabeth Taylor an emotional extremism, a dangerously greater need to be loved than to love. Me, I was too cautious and inhibited and scared to give in to extremism of any kind in sobriety, emotional or otherwise. But when I drank, it happened. When I drank, the part that felt dangerous and needy grew bright and strong and real. The part that coveted love kicked into gear. The yes grew louder than the no. The first time Meg had sex, her best friend advised her, "Just get drunk. It'll be easy." So that's exactly what she did. She got drunk then, and she got drunk the next time, and after a while the idea of having sex with a man without getting drunk first seemed pretty much impossible. Meg grew up the same time I did, coming of age in the late 1960s and early 1970s, long before people talked about things like safe sex or even contraception. The picture of female sexuality she acquired came from movies and TV. A little Marilyn Monroe here, a little Mary Tyler Moore there. Sex bomb, good girl. Those were really the only two options, and even if you strove to emulate one of those, no one really told you how to be a sex bomb, how to be a good girl. How did these ideals translate into practical behavior? Meg was scared of her own body, and she was scared of men's bodies, and so most of the time she'd just lie there with her drunkenness and her doubts. She felt as though she'd missed some key set of instructions, as though she was supposed to know instinctively how to move her body in ways that would be pleasing to herself and her partner, as though her lack of information on this subject signaled some fundamental weakness or failure on her part. So she drank, and the drink loosened her up enough to act sexual. Meg's story, her shyness and shame and confusion, is achingly familiar. Bad, semi-consensual, drunken sex. So many women I know did this. So many still do. At least a quarter of the students surveyed in a 1995 Harvard School of Public Health study on campus drinking said they'd suffered an unwanted sexual advance as a result of drinking. That same year, a Columbia University study reported that alcohol plays a role in 90% of rapes on college campuses. So Meg is typical. She did it, I did it. We lay there staring at the ceiling and just wanting it to end. We woke up in a haze some morning in some man's bed, not really remembering how we got there or what happened next. We found sex compelling and terrifying and foreign, and we drank to deal with it, just drank our way through. This is a classic story, and I can see myself reading from the same script over and over. I can see myself being groped by a boy in high school, feeling that combination of shock and curiosity, and drinking to counter the feelings. I can see myself in college, reeling up the stairs towards Bruce's dorm room, out of control, too drunk to have feelings. I can see myself flirting at a party, not knowing how to stop the flirting from escalating, not knowing how to turn off what I've seemed to turn on, and drinking to shut down the confusion this generates, drinking to keep myself going. I can almost feel the drink, feel how central it was to such experiences. Deaden the shock, facilitate the exploration. Voila, no problem, I can do this. I never once went out with a man who didn't like to get drunk, never. Right from the start, the idea of going out with a man who didn't like to tie one on was unthinkable to me, and would be for many years. This seemed perfectly reasonable, to choose drinking men. Alcohol felt like the cement in female sexuality, at least it did to me. Over the years, the two had become so deeply linked that for the longest time I simply couldn't imagine one without the other. A first kiss without drinks? Forget it. Sex without liquor? No way. A naturally inhibited person, someone who grew up feeling mystified and insecure about what it meant to feel sexual, I turned to liquor the way a dancer turns toward music. It felt central to the process, central to my ability to shut down the voices of self-criticism in my own head and simply let go, move to a different kind of music. The first man I ever fell in love with was named David. He was a friend of a friend who lived in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I met him there during spring vacation my senior year of high school. We stayed together through college and for several years after that. Big and uncomplicated and beautiful in a rugged way. That's how he struck me from the start, like the southwestern landscape, as different from the men I'd known before as Boston was from Santa Fe. He was originally from Montana, and he had the chiseled good looks of a mountain boy. I loved him almost immediately. Alcohol, of course, coursed through our romance like a river, providing the undercurrents. I wasn't aware of this at the time, but one of the things that attracted me so deeply to David was the role liquor occupied in his life. The day we met, we drank tequila sunrises at a bar in Santa Fe, and I remember the particularly giddy high you get from tequila, and I remember the way David's hair fell against his forehead, a single dark curl. That was such a powerful combination, the giddy high and the sight of him. I was drunk the first time he kissed me, drunk the first time we slept together, drunk the first time I told him I loved him. I don't think David was an alcoholic. He was one of those people who simply liked to drink and knew how and when to stop when he'd had too much. But he managed to keep a steady supply of drink around him, and I grew to depend on its presence. Bottles of beer in the refrigerator at the end of the day, bottles of tequila on the shelves to mix with lime and grenadine, cases of beer in the back seat of his car for day trips to the mountains. It was always there, liquor was, helping us to blur the boundaries and deaden the fear, helping us protect ourselves from one another. I was by no means a raging alcoholic when I fell in love with David, but I suppose you could say the predilection was there, that I was on the road to becoming one. I have a lot of good drinking memories from those days, drinking Coors beer under the sun by a Santa Fe swimming pool, sipping wine in the back of David's pickup truck at night on a New Mexican mountainside, drinking champagne under the stars in the high desert. But I also have a lot of unpleasant memories, memories of blackouts, memories of explosive liquor-laced fights, a particularly embarrassing memory of drinking an entire gallon of cheap white wine during a drive from New Mexico to Colorado, en route to visit my sister at a summer camp where she was working, then staggering out of the car when we arrived, loud and obnoxious and falling down drunk. I was 18 then. My sister was appalled. More to the point, I think my relationship with alcohol began to deepen and shift around that time, my college years, moving from a simple tool of self-transformation, a way to relax and feel less inhibited, a way to be more sexual and open and light, into something more complicated, a more deeply ingrained way of coping with the world. Looking back, I can see how certain patterns were beginning to develop, certain classically alcoholic ways of managing feelings and conflicts in relationships. Almost by definition, alcoholics are lousy at relationships. We melt into them in that muddied, liquid way, rather than marching into them with any real sense of strength or self-awareness. We become so accustomed to transforming ourselves into new and improved versions of ourselves that we lose the core version, the version we were born with, the version that might learn to connect with others in a meaningful way. We are uncomfortable, often desperately uncomfortable, with closeness, and alcohol has the insidious dual effect of deadening the discomfort and also preventing us from ever really overcoming it. We become too adept at sidestepping the feelings with drink to address them directly. Feel conflicted? Drink. Insecure? Have a drink. Angry? Drink. In fact, as much as I loved David, my feelings for him confused and scared me. I'd found in David another antidote to my family style. a nice, uncomplicated, loving, regular guy, unburdened by insight and self-analysis. And I found my own attraction to him disturbing. Did it reflect badly on me somehow, this choice of a tall, dark, slightly goofy, non-intellectual boyfriend? Was there something wrong with me for needing someone so different from the people I'd grown up with? Were my own appetites for hugs and sexuality and liquor inappropriate? Geography protected me from those questions for a long time. The summer after I met David, I went off to college, to Brown. He stayed in Santa Fe, in school, and we conducted the relationship over 3,000 miles for the next 3 years, binging on intimacy during periodic reunions, then retreating from it during separations. But that strategy fell apart my senior year of college when David, who'd graduated by then, moved to Rhode Island to live with me. The dynamic suddenly changed, and so in turn did my relationship with liquor. David and I lived in an apartment together off campus, and I felt conflicted by his presence almost immediately, as though he wouldn't fit in, as though there was something wrong with me for trying to merge these two lives, my Brown life and my David life. So without really being aware of it, I split my life into two that year, going to classes and working obsessively at the library during the day, returning to David, who'd gotten a job with a small marketing firm, in the evening. At night we drank, and I spent that year feeling tense, so I had to work hard to keep the two worlds apart. Alcoholics compartmentalize. This was classic behavior, although I wouldn't have known that back then. I've heard the story in AA meetings time after time. Alcoholics who end up leading double lives, and sometimes triple and quadruple lives, because they never learned how to lead a single honest one that's based on a clear sense of who they are and what they really need. I once heard a woman at a meeting define alcoholism as a fundamental inability to be honest, not so much with other people, but with the self. She talked about attaching herself to lovers all through college and graduate school as a way of avoiding the messy, fearful business of growing up, as a way of cashing in the chips of her core being by simply handing them over to someone else, letting others define her. Alcoholics can be ace chameleons, twisting ourselves into 2, 3, 4 versions of ourselves and using drink to lubricate the transformations. You tell me who to be, and you, and now you. When she described this, I flashed immediately onto that year with David, onto the way I split myself into two separate people, playing distinct roles in each life. The David life, which was social and sexual and awash in drink and hidden conflict, and the academic life, which was disciplined and cerebral and restrained. The academic life, appropriately enough, was also defined by a man, a professor named Roger, who headed the English program. He was in his 40s, and he had a razor-sharp intellect, and he was the first professor at college who'd made me feel special. I'd wanted that feeling desperately. Brown had felt enormous and confusing to me, and I'd foundered there for the first few years, looking in the vaguest way for someone to give me a sense of purpose, someone to please. Roger did just that. In my senior year, he became my advisor, and under his direction, I wrote a prize-winning thesis, graduating from Brown with honors. 2 days after my graduation, I went out to lunch with Roger, a celebratory gesture on his part. He'd suggested this after the graduation ceremony, and he called me the next day and arranged to pick me up at my apartment. We drove to a small, sunny restaurant about 10 minutes away from campus, and he ordered us martinis. Then he ordered wine with lunch. We ate lobster salads and talked about writing. After lunch, in his car, Roger leaned over suddenly and kissed me on the mouth. I was startled and scared and confused when he kissed me, but I was also drunk, so I let him. I let him keep kissing me, and I let him put his hand on my breast. And when he called me on the phone a few days later and asked me to have lunch with him again, I agreed because I didn't know what else to say. I must have gotten drunk with Roger 6 or 7 times that summer. We'd drive to a different restaurant each time, and we'd have many drinks, usually martinis like I'd had with my father. And after lunch, blind drunk in the daylight, we'd sit in his car and I'd let him kiss me again. I'd close my eyes, panicked inside, but numb, very numb, and I'd feel his breath on my neck and his tongue in my mouth, and I'd just sit there, not knowing how I'd gotten into the situation and not knowing how in the world to get out. I couldn't have done this without drinking. David would go off to work in the morning, and I'd go off to lunch later in the day with Roger, and I'd sit there in the car and worry drunkenly about getting home getting home before David and sobering up and trying to keep the anxiety out of my eyes. One day Roger asked me about David, and I told him he was moving to Chicago at the end of the summer to go to graduate school. Roger smiled. "Oh, good," he said. "Then we can become lovers." Lovers? I'd graduated that spring without a clue about where I was headed. Writing loomed as an ill-defined but daunting possibility. So did medical school, psychiatry. But honestly, I hadn't so much as sent out a resume. Like I said, I didn't have a clue. "Oh, good, then we can become lovers." We were at an outdoor restaurant in Newport, Rhode Island when he said that, and I remember vividly that I picked up my glass and gulped down the rest of my drink. I thought I was going to throw up. For the next decade, I rarely talked to friends about the relationship with Roger, and when I did, I described it the easy way. He was the villain and I was the victim. There's truth in that, but it's also true that I put myself in his path, that I made myself an easy target, and that drinking facilitated that process. We'd had one lunch before the one where he kissed me, several weeks before my graduation. We drank martinis that time, too, and I could tell that Roger found me attractive. I also understood, however abstractly, that the martinis allowed me to indulge in that attraction, to flirt with it, to tap into a feeling of power I was otherwise too self-conscious and fearful to acknowledge. After the second or third drink, I know that I was leaning across the table, asking questions, smiling demurely at all the right moments, cultivating some ego-stroking blend of vulnerability and reverence. I don't remember how I really felt about him at the time, nor do I remember feeling physically attracted to him in any genuine way. What I do remember is the drive, to please, to generate approval, and to do that by somehow sexualizing the relationship, because that's the only way I knew how. And so when Roger took me out to lunch a few weeks later, and when he kissed me in the car afterwards, I felt shocked and confused and appalled, but also, oddly, victorious. The feeling was, I got what I wanted. I won. And because I understood I'd participated in the game, because I knew I'd worked on some semi-conscious level to draw him in, I somehow deprived myself of the ability to get out cleanly. How can you say no when you've worked to make someone else say yes? Alcohol puts you in such a box, leaves you with such an impossible equation. You have to sexualize the relationship in order to feel powerful, and you have to drink in order to feel sexual, and on some level you understand it's all fake, that the power is chemical, that it doesn't come from within you. I never told David about the episodes with Roger, but they inserted themselves into our relationship, creating another kind of distance. He'd ask me about my day. "Oh, it was fine," I'd say, and then I'd fall silent. I felt like I was carrying around a huge secret, which of course I was, and I jumped every time the phone rang, worried it would be Roger calling to set up another lunch. On the days I met Roger, I felt unbearably guilty. But I drank, and whatever deeper confusion I had about those relationships faded away, just faded out of consciousness. In fact, I was deeply confused. Confused about David, confused about Roger, confused about my apparent wish to be validated and defined by other people. But honesty, with the self, with others, is impossible when you're drinking. The liquor numbs the real feelings and the real fears and the real doubts. It deprives you of the courage it takes to be honest. You lose your hold on who you really are, and you just find yourself in bad situations. Sitting in some professor's car being groped. Sitting at dinner with your boyfriend withholding information. Keeping secrets. My father kept secrets, too. At the end of that summer, the Roger summer, my mother called me on the phone and said she had something she wanted to talk to me about. I remember sitting down at the kitchen table and thinking, someone's died. My mother never called to talk about anything serious, and her voice sounded odd and strained. "I'm thinking of leaving your father," she said. "You are?" She sounded edgy and embarrassed, as though explaining this was going to be exhausting. "Oh, sweetie," she said, "it's such a complicated business." Then she told me that my father had been having an affair. The relationship had been going on for 7 years, and she couldn't tolerate the betrayal anymore. She was about to go off to Martha's Vineyard for a few days to think things over. This was stunning news. You never would have known, just never. Thinking about my parents that afternoon, I couldn't remember one argument, one moment of overt tension, one episode that might have suggested anything so dramatic as an affair. and as I learned more, I'd be astonished at the lengths my parents had gone to protect us from their problems. My father had actually moved out for a few weeks while I was in college. I came home for a weekend during that time, and he moved back in for the 2 days I was there, so I wouldn't know. My instinctive reaction was to side with my mother, to react with horror and shock, but I also remember breathing a small sigh of relief at the news. It made my father a little less mysterious, helped put some of his remoteness and preoccupation in context. When I sat with him in those strange silences in the family living room, I had thought there was some inadequacy on my part that ground the conversation to a halt. I'd seen him all my life on such an epic scale, lost in his own grand thoughts, above me in my small concerns, possibly even frustrated or bored with me. And the news of his affair shifted the burden for the first time away from me and onto something else. Of course he was preoccupied. He was leading a double life. And of course he relied on that martini every evening. Coming home was a painful thing, an exercise in guilt and betrayal that needed easing daily. The information might have been shocking, but it also explained things to me, provided some central piece of the quiet puzzle that was our home. They broke up for about 3 days. My mother went to the vineyard, and my father moved in with the other woman, and then, finally, something shifted, and he decided he couldn't follow through, couldn't leave my mother. He called her, and over the next week they patched things back together. Years later, he told my sister that he drank almost the entire time he was there. Drinking was his solution, the medication for sexual conflict. The amazing thing, of course, is that you do all this drinking, all the keeping of secrets and withholding of information, all the self-medicating, without making the connection between the drink and the outcome. My father drank, and he stayed stuck in the relationship with the other woman, and stuck in the secrecy, and stuck in the feeling of ambivalence. And he didn't understand until it was way too late that all those actions were related, that the drink fostered the secrecy, and the secrecy fostered the stuck feeling, that drink and dishonesty and clouded vision were ultimately one and the same, weaving through each other like the threads of a tapestry. That summer with David and Roger, I picked up the threads of that same tapestry, drinking and weaving myself into a life that felt woefully overcomplicated, and I couldn't make the connection either. I wouldn't for many years. The hard things in life, the things you really learn from, happen with a clear mind. About 6 weeks after that first lunch with Roger, I finally couldn't stand it anymore. Couldn't stand sitting in his car and letting him touch me like that anymore. So one day I summoned up all my nerve and went over to his office. I told him, tentatively but very soberly, that I couldn't see him anymore. He was sitting at his desk and he just stared at me. I stammered, I hope we can still be friends. Silence. Finally, Roger looked at me and said, "Well, if we're not going to be lovers, I don't see the point." I didn't see or speak to him again, but from that point on, I could hate him instead of merely fear him. Years later, I heard he had died, dropped dead of a heart attack while jogging on the east side of Providence. I didn't feel a thing. That fall, after David moved away to Chicago and my parents nearly broke up and I said goodbye to Roger, I learned to drink alone. That's the year my sister started worrying about my drinking, more than a decade before I finally quit. She came to my apartment one day, opened the refrigerator, and saw a large jug of white wine, nearly empty. "Did you drink all this by yourself?" she asked. "Sure," I said, "why not?" As my drinking progressed, I learned to be more discreet. So would most alcoholics I know. We hid what we drank, and when we drank it, and how much, and under what circumstances. We hid it from our friends and families. Often we took pains to hide it from total strangers. My friend Max used to tell liquor store clerks he needed brandy in order to bake a Grand Marnier soufflé. He did this several times a week. He'd go up to the rows of nips they keep by the cash register, point to a little brandy bottle, and ask, "Do you think that's 2 tablespoons? I need some for a soufflé." Then he'd walk out with 3 or 4 of them tucked in a bag. I did this too. Late in my drinking, when I'd buy nips of Hennessy to hide in my bathrobe pockets, I used to ask for them as an afterthought, as though I just remembered I needed a tiny bit for a recipe. "Oh," I'd say, "I also need a couple of those little cognacs. Is that Hennessy?" "Yeah, 2 of those." I've heard countless versions of this story in countless AA meetings. Lots of us would shop at different stores every day, sometimes going miles out of our way to get to a new liquor store in order to hide the exact levels of our consumption from the salespeople. Two bottles here, two bottles there, a case somewhere else. Recycling is a problem to the active alcoholic. You have to see all those bottles heaped together in the recycling bin, and that can be a disconcerting image. Luckily, I did most of my solitary alcoholic drinking in communities that didn't then recycle, so I'd pile the bottles into a heavy plastic garbage bag and lug them out to a curb or heave them into a dumpster, hoping no one nearby heard all the glass clinking and rattling as I went along. Alcoholic drinking is by nature solitary drinking, drinking whose true nature is concealed from the outside world, and in some respects, from the drinker as well. You think you're drinking to have fun, to be sociable or more relaxed, but you're also drinking to shut down, to retreat. It's not at all unusual in AA to hear people refer to alcohol as a best friend, and to mean that on the most visceral level. When you're drinking, liquor occupies the role of a lover or a constant companion. It sits there on its refrigerator shelves or on the counter or in the cabinet like a real person, as present and reliable as a best friend. At the end, when I started hiding bottles of scotch around the house and tucking nips of brandy into my bathrobe pockets, I did so in the manner of a child who's afraid to be without a favorite blanket or a teddy bear. Protect me. Shield me from being alone in my own head. In the summer of 1981, after I'd graduated, I moved into a tiny studio on the east side of Providence, and it was there that I fell in love, truly fell in love, with white wine. I almost felt like an adult in that apartment, living on my own for the first time, but for the most part that was a superficial sensation, the product of simple physical acts like unlocking the door to my apartment, clicking across the wood floor in my grown-up shoes, setting the groceries on the counter, or, more to the point, like taking a bottle of wine from the refrigerator, sliding out the cork, pouring the liquid into a fluted glass. That seemed like such a sophisticated thing to do. Pour the wine, light a fire, settle down on the sofa and leaf through a magazine. And the ritual seemed full of promise and safety. A code of behavior that could lead me straight toward independence. In truth, I didn't act the part very well at all. I was broke all the time, waitressing at a restaurant in downtown Providence, and I started buying wine in gallon jugs. I unscrewed the cap at the end of the day, rather than easing out the cork with that satisfying grown-up pop. I rarely lit fires, and I was too distracted to leaf through magazines with anything like pleasure or concentration. Most evenings I sat on my futon, which I rolled into a sofa until I went to sleep at night, and I listened to the same Kenny Loggins record over and over because it reminded me of David who'd moved away, and I got drunk and cried. Drinking alone is enormously self-protective, at least in theory. The solitude relieves you of human contact, which can feel burdensome to even the most gregarious alcoholic, and the alcohol relieves you of your own thoughts, of the dark pressure of your own company. Drinking alone is what you do when you can't stand the feeling of living in your own skin. One December afternoon that year in Providence, during a blizzard, I sat in my apartment looking out the window. Snowflakes spiraled down to the ground, and I spiraled down along with them, descending gradually into self-pity until I was blanketed in the feeling. I'd worked the lunch shift and then come home, sat down on the sofa with my list of things to do. Call X about creative writing workshop, call Y about freelancing. These tasks terrified me. I felt so inadequate and small inside, so afraid of failing. I hadn't checked anything off. I remember sitting there feeling paralyzed and passive and full of self-loathing, and by 6 o'clock or so I put on my coat and trudged off in the snow to the liquor store to buy a bottle of wine. I drank most of it that night, sitting on the futon sofa, and before I went to sleep I picked up my journal and scrawled, "I'm so depressed. Please make this feeling go away." I don't know to whom that please was addressed, some external force, I suppose. Some abstract sense of a fate that loomed in the distance, or an energy with the power to shape circumstances in my favor. There's something about sober living and sober thinking, about facing long afternoons without anesthesia, that disabuses you of the belief in externals, shows you that strength and hope come not from circumstances, but from the simple accumulation of active experience, from gritting the teeth and checking the items off the list one by one, even though it's painful and you're afraid. But when you drink, you can't do that. When you drink, you can't make the distinction between getting through painful feelings and getting away from them. All you can do is just sit there, numb and sipping, numb and drunk. Another entry from that year is dated September 28, 1981, 13 years before I quit drinking. It says, "Spaced out brain. I'm worried I'm an alcoholic." It amazes me now to see that a part of me recognized the problem so long ago, but I guess that's the way alcoholism works. You know when you don't know. Or more accurately, you know when the part of you that wants no part of this knowledge immediately slips into gear, sliding the fear into a new category. You wake up in the morning, and presto, it's reclassified, a little problem with drinking, something you'll take care of when you're less depressed. The movie Clean and Sober is a somewhat simplistic look at addiction and recovery, but there's one very vivid scene about midway through, when Michael Keaton comes home from rehab and spends his first night alone in his apartment. He scrubs the place until it gleams, light from halogen lamps glinting off the chrome furniture, and then he sits. Sits on one chair for a few minutes, then gets up and sits on another. He's restless and edgy, and you can tell from the way he keeps getting up and sitting down that he feels completely at sea, clueless about how to comfort himself or entertain himself or just sit there comfortably in his own skin. I saw that movie in 1989 when it was released, and I squirmed. One of these days that's going to be me, I thought, forced to figure out how to live alone, without the armor. The armor, of course, is protection from all the things we might actually feel if we allowed ourselves to feel at all. Over the course of my last years of drinking, I lived in another studio apartment, this one in Boston's North End. On nights when I had no plans, I'd stop on my way home and pick up a bottle of white wine. The wine would be my primary staple for the evening, but during those last few years, I began to understand that a single bottle wouldn't quite do the trick, so usually I pick up two beers as well. Not a whole six-pack, just two lone bottles of Molson Golden, which always looked perfectly innocent sitting on the counter beside the wine when I went to pay. As soon as I got home, I'd crack open the first beer and drink it with a deep relief. In ways, I acknowledged that my little stockpile of booze served a very specific purpose. It kept me from that piercing consciousness of self, kept me from the task of learning to tolerate my own company. Without liquor, I'd feel like a trapped animal. Without liquor, I didn't know what to do with myself, and I mean that in the most literal sense, as though my thoughts and my limbs were foreign to me and I'd missed some key set of instructions about how to use them. I used to feel that way on Sunday mornings when I'd wake up alone in the apartment with nothing before me but unstructured time. Here I am in my apartment. Here I am, puttering through the kitchen. Here I am, washing a dish and setting it on the rack. Here I am, conscious of being alone, conscious of my own breath and my own skin and my own thoughts. Here I am waiting, and if I keep doing this, if I don't find some way out of my own head, I'll die of boredom or go insane or explode at any moment. The drink diffused that explosive feeling, numbed the self-awareness. The paradoxical thing about drinking alone, the insidious thing really, is that it can create an illusion of emotional authenticity, something you see as false only in retrospect. When it didn't completely shut me down or numb me out, liquor often seemed like the one thing that gave me access to my true feelings, a route to real emotion. I could cry when I drank. I could melt down. I could call people and ask for help. Legions of alcoholics do this, almost every alcoholic I know. We'd come in after a long night out drinking, or we'd sit on the sofa for too many hours in a row, finally getting so restless and morose we couldn't stand it anymore, and in a fit of desperation we'd pick up the phone. Okay, it's 1 a.m., someone must be awake in California. A friend of mine talked about this with a group of us one night in a restaurant, and we all rolled our eyes, cringing with the memory. Reaching for the address book, seeking out that one person in the right time zone who won't mind being disturbed by a slightly slurred voice on the other line. Closing one eye so the numbers on the phone pad don't blur when you try to punch them out. Not quite knowing what you're doing, what you're after, why you're even calling. Are you depressed, lonely, insane? But you do it anyway. Drink and reach for the phone. Drink and search for some kind of human contact. But liquor is deceptive. The feelings it generates are illusory. The next day you don't remember the action or the feelings that propelled you towards the phone. When you wake up in the morning, the only real thing you have is a headache. One night, 4 or 5 years before I quit, I went out for drinks with some friends on a Friday night, then went out to dinner and drank more, then ended up at a bar on Newbury Street. I don't remember much of the evening, just that I drank and drank and drank, and at some point, some deep-seated instinct for self-preservation must have kicked in, and I knew I had to get home, and I ended up in a cab. I was seeing Michael by then, and I took the cab to his house. I've no memory of the drive there. Michael was out with some friends, and I have the dimmest memory of going into his bedroom, picking up the phone at the foot of the bed, and calling my mother. It must have been 1 or 2 in the morning, and I recall, but just vaguely, that I heard her voice on the phone, and I started to cry. I remember her voice on the end of the line. "What's the matter, sweetie?" I slurred out the words. "Mom, I think I have a drinking problem." I don't remember the rest of the conversation, just that I wept into the phone for a long time and finally settled down. At some point, we must have finished talking and hung up, and I must have passed out. Michael got home sometime after 2 and found his front door wide open, every light in his apartment on, and me crashed on the bed with all my clothes on. He got me undressed and under the covers. I don't remember that either. And I woke up the next morning with that horrible, disoriented sense of dread, knowing I'd done something really bad, but able to recall only the outlines. When I remembered enough, I got out of bed and called my mother again. "I'm sorry I woke you last night," I said. "Do you remember what we talked about?" she asked. I said I did, and I promised her I'd do something about it, get my drinking under control. She asked, "Do you think you can?" And I said, "I promise, Mom, I'll deal with it." This was 3 years before I made, and failed to keep, the very same promise during our walk on the beach on Martha's Vineyard. I don't know how much my mother worried about my drinking between that late-night call and our walk at Menemsha Pond, and I don't know if she shared the details about either conversation with my father. He never talked to me about my drinking. I hung up the phone that morning and thought about my mother, about how alarming it must have been for her to hear me like that, incoherent and sobbing in the middle of the night. I felt intensely guilty for a second and intensely ashamed, but the feelings didn't last. Like I said, all you're really aware of after a night like that is the hangover. "Get me the Advil," you think. "I feel like shit." You roll over in bed. "Let me go back to sleep. I'll deal with it later." The following questions, put together by the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence, are designed to help people decide whether or not they have a drinking problem. 1. Do you occasionally drink heavily after a disappointment, a quarrel, or when the boss gives you a hard time? 2. When you have trouble or feel under pressure, do you always drink more heavily than usual? 3. Have you noticed that you're able to handle more liquor than you did when you were first drinking? 4. Did you ever wake up on the morning after and discover that you couldn't remember part of the evening before, even though your friends tell you you didn't pass out? 5. When drinking with other people, do you try to have a few extra drinks when others won't know it? 6. Are there certain occasions when you feel uncomfortable if alcohol isn't available? 7. Have you recently noticed that when you begin drinking, you're in more of a hurry to get the first drink than you used to be? 8. Do you sometimes feel a little guilty about your drinking? 9. Are you secretly irritated when your family or friends discuss your drinking? 10. Have you recently noticed an increase in the frequency of your memory blackouts? 11. Do you often find that you wish to continue drinking after your friends say they've had enough? 12. Do you usually have a reason for the occasions when you drink heavily? 13. When you're sober, do you often regret things you've done or said while drinking? 14. Have you tried switching brands or following different plans for controlling your drinking? 15. Have you often failed to keep the promises you've made to yourself about controlling or cutting down on your drinking? 16. Have you ever tried to control your drinking by making a change of jobs or moving to a new location? 17. Do you try to avoid family or close friends while you're drinking? 18. Are you having an increasing number of financial and work problems? 19. Do more people seem to be treating you unfairly without good reason? 20. Do you eat very little or irregularly when you're drinking? 21. Do you sometimes have the shakes in the morning and find that it helps to have a little drink? 22. Have you recently noticed that you can't drink as much as you once did? 23. Do you sometimes stay drunk for several days at a time? 24. Do you sometimes feel very depressed and wonder if life is worth living? 25. Sometimes after periods of drinking, do you see or hear things that aren't there? 26. Do you get terribly frightened after you've been drinking heavily? The National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence says that if you answer yes to any of the above questions, you have some symptoms that may indicate alcoholism. People who answer yes to questions 1 through 8 are said to be in the early stages of alcoholism, which typically last from 10 to 15 years. Yes answers to questions 9 through 21 indicate middle-stage alcoholism, which usually lasts from 2 to 5 years. Questions 22 through 26 indicate the beginning of the final stage. In its last stage, alcoholism can kill. Heavy and chronic drinking can harm virtually every organ and system in the body. It's the single most important cause of illness and death from liver disease in the U.S. It can increase the risk of cancer, cardiovascular disease, and such infectious diseases as pneumonia and tuberculosis. It can also alter brain cell function, shrink the cerebral cortex, throw the body's hormonal system out of balance, and lead to sexual dysfunction and infertility. The Office of the Secretary of Health and Human Services noted in its 1993 Congressional Report on Alcohol and Health that in 1988, 15.3 million Americans met the criteria for alcohol abuse or alcohol dependence. Alcohol contributes to nearly 100,000 deaths a year, making it the nation's third largest cause of preventable death. Tobacco and poor diet and exercise patterns are the largest two causes. Those afflicted by alcoholism and other illnesses it causes occupy as many as half the hospital beds in the U.S. on any given day. It's estimated that alcohol is a factor in approximately 50% of all homicides and 30% of all suicides. I first came across a copy of those questions in Nan Robertson's book, Getting Better. At that point, I answered yes to the first 15 questions, and I remember thinking I had another 5 or so years to go. When we're that deeply in love with drink, we have no idea what kind of fire we're playing with. No one really knows precisely why some people become alcoholic while others don't, but scientists are closing in on some of the causes. Alcoholism is probably an inherited phenomenon. Research over the last 30 years has begun to confirm that alcoholism runs in families, suggesting that although environmental factors may contribute to the development of the disease, most alcoholics probably have a genetic predisposition to it as well. Addiction to alcohol is also a neurological phenomenon, the result of a complex set of molecular alterations that take place in the brain when it's excessively and repeatedly exposed to the drug. The science of addiction is complicated, but the basic idea is fairly straightforward. Alcohol appears to wreak havoc on the brain's natural systems of craving and reward, compromising the functioning of the various neurotransmitters and proteins that create feelings of well-being. Essentially, drinking artificially activates the brain's reward system. You have a martini or two and the alcohol acts on the part of the brain's circuitry that makes you feel good, increasing the release of the neurotransmitter dopamine, which is central to feelings of pleasure and reward. Over time, and given the right combination of vulnerability to alcoholism and actual alcohol abuse, the brain develops what are known as compensatory adaptations to all that artificial revving up. In an effort to bring its own chemistry back into its natural equilibrium, it works overtime to decrease dopamine release, ultimately leaving those same pleasure-reward circuits depleted. A vicious cycle ensues. By drinking too much, you basically diminish your brain's ability to manufacture feelings of well-being and calm on its own, and you come to depend increasingly on the artificial stimulus, alcohol, to produce those feelings. This is why an alcoholic may wake up after a night of heavy drinking struggling with two competing motivations. The logical thinking part of the brain, taking note of the hangover and the feelings of remorse, kicks in with determination and resolve. Drinking too much is bad. I'm going to cut down. I mean it. But the less rational part, this far more mysterious, primitive, and powerful circuitry of pleasure and need, speaks in a more urgent, compelling voice. No, it says, I feel bad, and I need a very specific thing, alcohol, in order to feel good again. Seen in this light, alcoholism may be a disease in the purest sense, a physiological state producing an overwhelming sense of dis-ease. The idea that alcoholism is a physical illness was first formally advanced in this country in 1960 with the publication of a book called The Disease Concept of Alcoholism. Today, that thinking is standard in medical circles, although the disease theory remains controversial among some doctors and researchers. who believe there isn't sufficient proof of the genetic or biological origin to label it a disease. That controversy aside, the idea that alcoholism is comparable to other illnesses, diabetes, say, is hard for an active alcoholic to internalize. After all, alcoholism doesn't feel like a disease. Tangible physical symptoms, such as hangovers or tremors in the hands, may appear, but they also pass. They're easy to ignore. They don't tend to impede the drinker in clear, obvious ways. The morning after that drunken phone call with my mother, for example, I still couldn't have waltzed into a doctor's office, taken a blood test, and walked out with a definitive diagnosis. Yes, you are ill, or no, you are not. Back in those years of drinking alone in Providence, and for more than a decade after that, I was nowhere near believing I had an illness, nowhere near even considering it. The body, after all, colludes with the mind, and I was still profoundly affected by the simple matter of physiology, by the simple truth that alcohol made me feel better. Plus, until I got sober, alcoholism seemed more to me like a moral issue than a physical one. This is one of our culture's most basic assumptions about the disease and one of its most destructive. We figure that drinking too much is a sign of weakness and lack of self-restraint, that it's bad, that it can be overcome by will. Child of an analyst that I am, I'd add insight to the list of remedies, and I did all the way to rehab. Tease out the reasons you drink, the hidden rages and fears, the psychological roots, and the problem will resolve itself. Think your way to mental health. Turn it over to the psychiatric couch. In fact, that's an enormously self-defeating line of thought. When I finally went to rehab, I was astonished to hear lectures about alcoholism that suggested my drinking really did have physiological roots, that I lost control and drank as much as I did on certain nights because a set of very powerful physical mechanisms were at work. Your brain's ability to manufacture the stuff you need to feel good is compromised, one physician told us during my first week, describing some of the current neurological research. If you abstain, it'll get its balance back. I sat there in awe, thinking for the first time, oh, so it wasn't all me. So it wasn't all a matter of insight and will. Neurology may help explain why traditional talk therapies have been so ineffective in addressing alcohol addiction. You can load up an alcoholic on a diet of insight, but the body tends to speak more directly than the mind. If the brain is screaming for booze, no number of revelations about underlying causes is going to counter that call. Science may also explain why relapse rates are so high. Those neurological reward circuits have extremely long and powerful memories. And once the simple message, alcohol equals pleasure, gets imprinted into the drinker's brain, it may stay there indefinitely, perhaps a lifetime. Environmental cues, the sight of a wine glass, the smell of gin, a walk past a favorite bar, can trigger the wish to drink in a heartbeat, and they often do. One of the most commonly cited statistics on recidivism comes from a 1980 report by the RAND Corporation, a study that tracked a group of 900 alcoholic men over a period of 4 years. Of those, only 28% remained free of alcohol problems both at 18 months and at 4 years after entering treatment. Only 15% were in continuous remission for the entire 4 years. Once you've crossed the line into alcoholism, the percentages are not in your favor. There appears to be no safe way to drink again, no way to return to normal, social, controlled drinking. Which is not to say that alcoholics don't try. The struggle to control intake, modify it, cut it back, deploy 100 different drinking strategies in the effort, is one of the most universal hallmarks of alcoholic behavior. We swear off hard liquor and resolve to stick to beer. We develop new rules. We'll never drink alone. We'll never drink in the morning. We'll never drink on the job. We'll only drink on weekends or after 5 o'clock. We'll coat our stomachs with milk or olive oil before we go out drinking to keep ourselves from getting too drunk. We'll have a glass of water for every glass of wine. We'll do anything, anything, to show ourselves that we can, in fact, drink responsibly. In the past, if we got desperate enough, we checked ourselves into asylums, which for decades was the only formal option for the low-bottom drunk. Alcohol rehabilitation centers as we know them today didn't come onto the scene until the 1950s and 60s. The period before that is known today as the snake pit era of alcohol treatment. Alcoholics were called inebes, short for inebriates, and when hospitalized, they were usually locked up with the mentally ill. When Bill Wilson, who co-founded AA in 1935, was first hospitalized for the disease in 1933, he was admitted to the Charles B. Towns Hospital in Manhattan. According to Nan Robertson, the basic protocol there was known as purge and puke. Let the guy dry out, load him up with cathartics like belladonna and castor oil, and send him on his way. Wilson was hospitalized there 3 times without lasting results. Wilson, of course, ultimately stumbled upon the one remedy that seemed to work, talking with other alcoholics. The reasons this works are varied and elusive, but one of the most essential ingredients has to do with the power of group perspective and support. Alcoholics have notoriously selective memories. No matter how sickening the hangover, how humiliating the drunken behavior, how dangerous the blind drunk drive home, we seem incapable of recalling consistently or clearly how bad things got when we drank. Drinkers talk about losing the power of choice over alcohol. At certain times, when the need or desire to drink becomes too strong, those memories simply evaporate. Willpower vanishes, resolutions dissolve, defenses crumble. AA offers a solution. The fellowship, the meetings and stories and friendships formed, help alcoholics counter that flaw of selective memory. Help us remember what it was like to drink, what happened to us, and how others like us changed when they stopped. And the 12 steps of recovery outlined in AA literature and meetings help counter the buildup of suffering and humiliation, offering a way of life that has to do with honesty and self-awareness and healing, with addressing directly rather than anesthetizing the fears and rages and feelings that compelled us to drink in the first place. In most of the AA meetings I go to, about 3/4 of the people introduce themselves as alcoholics, as in, my name is Joe and I'm an alcoholic, and the rest introduce themselves as alcoholics and addicts. Many of us, in other words, have dabbled in other addictive substances or behaviors, and it's not hard to see why. At heart, all addictions are driven by the same impulses, and most accomplish the same goals. You just use a different substance or take a slightly different path to get there. For some people, the substance is another drug, pot or cocaine or heroin. For others, it's a behavior like gambling or compulsive shopping, or even something more obscure like self-mutilation. But for women, the addictive path often winds around alcohol and heads straight to food. The Harvard University Eating Disorder Center estimates that 25% of women with eating disorders also suffer from a substance abuse problem. Sometimes I think I know all of them, women who traded in one form of pain and obsession for another, or who danced around with both at the same time. These are women who toss around the phrase food issues a lot, as in, I had a lot of food issues back then. Anyone who struggled with a distorted body image or hyperconsciousness about weight understands what those words mean. They're shorthand for self-hatred and self-sabotage, for loss of control or fear of it, for all the other particularly female rages and fears that make women so crazy about food. I'm consistently amazed to hear women talk about their multiple relationships with addiction, the way they combine 2 or 3, the way they shift from one to another, so naturally and gracefully you might think they were changing partners in a dance. Addictions segue into one another with such ease. A bout of compulsive overeating fills you with shame and sexual inferiority, which fills you with self-loathing and doubt, which leads you to a drink, which temporarily counters the self-hatred and fills you with chemical confidence, which leads you to sleep with a man you don't love, which leads you circling back to shame, and there you go, the dance can begin again. The dance will begin again, for the music is always there in women's minds, laced with undertones of fear and anger, urging us on into the same sad circles of restraint and abandon, courtship and flight. I use the phrase women's minds deliberately, as opposed to female alcoholics' minds, because I don't think I know a single woman, alcoholic or otherwise, who doesn't engage in that dance to some extent, sporadically or regularly, fueled by varying substances and propelled by varying degrees of self-destruction. Anyone who observes women at a cocktail party knows what I mean. The way a woman will circle the hors d'oeuvre tray, glass of wine in hand, the way she'll hover over a stuffed mushroom or a cube of cheese and say something about it in a voice just one shade too high. Oh, I think I'll have just one more, or, oh, I better not. Alcoholics and addicts may inhabit the center of the dance floor, but countless others, men and women, stand at the fringes, placing one toe over the line from time to time, then drawing it back to safety. Multiple addictions are both helpful and insidious. Helpful because they can propel a lot of people into treatment and recovery at relatively young ages, and insidious because they can mask each other, fueling denial for longer periods of time. This no doubt happened to me. Started with one addiction, traded it in for another, and in the process managed to deny I had a genuine problem with either. Starting in the fall of 1982, a year after I graduated from college, I entered into a dance with anorexia, starving myself with exactly the same zeal I'd drink with later on, and developing an obsession around the behavior that would pare my weight down from its normal level, 120 pounds, to a low of 83. Like any addictive behavior, it started slowly at first, building momentum so gradually I couldn't see the stranglehold it began to develop on my life. And like drinking, anorexia was a strategy, a way of managing strong emotion. I'd moved from my studio in Providence into a new apartment with two roommates. I'd gotten my first job as a reporter, working for a small alternative newspaper called The Eagle. On the surface, my life appeared to be moving forward. New friends, a sense of professional direction. But I was still as scared and shy and angry as I'd ever been. So in a sense, I built myself a cage, constructed a set of walls out of my own bones. The metaphor is apt. Anorexia had the feel of a cage, a safe place where I could feel protected and removed and disciplined and, above all, in control. In the summer of 1982, my mother had been diagnosed with breast cancer. She had a lumpectomy and radiation treatments, then began a year's worth of chemotherapy. David, who'd gone off to Chicago the year before, came to visit me right around the time she went into the hospital. He'd planned to spend July and August in Providence with me, but decided after a few weeks to spend the bulk of his time traveling in Europe with a friend instead. I was deeply disappointed by this and furious. A little stirring of rage, something I often felt and often quashed, rose up in me when he announced his plans, but I didn't say anything. Instead, I walked him to the train station, said goodbye, then headed back toward my office, thinking, I am not going to eat. A hunger strike, as willful and deliberate as a carefully crafted political statement. At the end of the summer, David stopped in Providence on his way back to Chicago. In 6 weeks, I'd lost 17 pounds and chopped off all my hair. I wouldn't make the connection until long after I quit drinking, but I looked like a cancer patient. At the time, though, I had no idea how angry I was at David, not a clue how worried I was about my mother's health. The feeling behind that decision, I am not going to eat, would take root in me over the next year, mutating from an ill-defined instinct into a mode of self-definition. I am not going to eat. I'm going to master my impulses. I am going to exert power over my appetite, and this will make me strong. In ways, the strategy worked. Starving made me feel special. I'd watch people through restaurant windows eating platefuls of food, or I'd see housewives exit grocery stores with bulging brown paper bags, and I'd imagine them cooking, stealing little nibbles from the pot on the stove. I'd feel above these people, superior, able to restrain where others surrendered. At a time when I felt essentially uncertain and worthless, starving gave me a goal, something to be good at. I was very, very good at it. In the fall of 1983, I ran a 6-mile road race, and one of my roommates took a picture of me crossing the finish line. In the photograph, my knees are wider than my thighs. Anorexia was marvelously effective in its own twisted way. I'd grown up believing that pain and conflict were to be held like secrets, not to be expressed. And paring myself down to skeletal form gave me a way to literally wear whatever pain I felt instead of voicing it. I'd grown fearful of sexuality, of being physically viewed and pursued by men. Starving gave me a way to physically whittle away the parts of me that looked and felt sexual. My breasts and hips, my curves. I stopped menstruating. I became hard and angular, like a 12-year-old boy. The parallels between anorexia and alcoholism astonish me today, the way they both serve to refract emotion and keep me at a distance from my own feelings, one through food and one through drink. When I was starving, I couldn't think about the deeper motives, couldn't contemplate the fact that I was young and scared and sexually threatened and angry. All I could think about was food, when I'd eat, where I'd eat, how much I'd permit myself to eat, and under what circumstances. I developed elaborate rituals around food, dozens of rules and taboos, and the few things I allowed myself to eat became objects of a kind of reverence to me, in the same way a glass of white wine would later on, or a first shot of Johnny Walker Black after work.